it's Wednesday, the 21st of May, and welcome to Career 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. The United Nations General Assembly convened its first ever high-level meeting on human rights violations in North Korea with testimonies from two North Korean defectors. We'll have more details in news briefing shortly. Coming up for Wednesday Election Watch, we look back at the first TV debate between the leading presidential candidates and assess where things stand with 2 weeks to go. And then on Korea Book Club, we review Snow Globe 2, the second and final part of a YA dystopian science fiction story by Park So-young. We have all that and more on today's Korea 24.
I give the floor to Ms. Guri Kang, SKP from the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
Thank you, Mr. President, Excellencies, distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen. In October 2023, I escaped from North Korea to South Korea on a small 10-meter wooden boat with my mother.
Two North Korean defectors took the floor at a landmark high-level United Nations General Assembly meeting on Tuesday to address human rights violations in North Korea. A UN official warned that the situation is worsening, while the defectors shared painful accounts of their experiences. Here's what defector Kang Gyuri had to say.
Three of my friends were executed, two of them in public for this tributing South Korean dramas. One of them was only 19 years old. At first, I could not believe this. Their crime was watching South Korean dramas and pushing them.
Our KBS World Radio news editor, Gui-jin, joins us in the studio to brief us on the remarks at the UN headquarters in New York, as well as some of our other headlines of the day. Gui-jin, hello.
Hello, John.
So I understand that this was the first high-level meeting on North Korean human rights at the UNGA. But first, what can you tell us about the testimonies?
Well, drawing attention at the UN General Assembly meeting Tuesday were the testimonies of these two North Korean escapees, Kang Gyuri and Kim Min-ju. They described in detail the hardships they had to face personally, as well as those facing North Koreans in general. Let's listen further to what Kang had to say.
The North Korean authorities are keenly aware of the impact of outside media. They won't keep the North Korean people in the dark and prevent them from daring to even dream of freedom. The COVID-19 lockdowns gave them a perfect excuse. An opportunity.
Well, another defector, Kim Min-ju, stated she was 11 years old when she escaped the North in 1999 with her mother and older sister after losing her father to starvation. She told the UN Assembly that young North Korean soldiers are caught up in a new kind of modern-day slavery in Russian-Ukraine war.
Today, young North Korean soldiers are caught up in a new kind of modern-day slavery, sent to fight in Russia's war in Ukraine. They have no idea where they are, whom they are fighting against, or why. And their lives become a means for Kim Jong-un regime to make money. While their parents left behind in North Korea are forced to endure the unbearable pain of losing their sons as cannon fodder of a foreign battlefield.
Elizabeth Salmon, the UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in North Korea, and other UN officials said the human rights situation in North Korea is worsening in many aspects. North Korea's UN Ambassador Kim Song denied the accusations, calling the invited witnesses the scum of the earth and saying they don't care about their parents or their families. The United Nations Security Council and the United Nations Human Rights Council have held meetings on human rights in North Korea, but this is the first time that the UN General Assembly has held a high-level meeting on the issue.
Let's turn to the latest on the campaign trail here in South Korea. Democratic Party presidential candidate Lee Jae-myung said the government should expand fiscal spending to ensure that money goes around in light of concerns of negative economic growth. What can you tell us?
While stumping in Incheon on Wednesday, Lee accused rival candidates of twisting his recent explanation of the concept of economic vitalization, which highlights that the economy is about the circulation of money. Lee said the government should expand its financial expenditure while giving laborers authority to take collective action, thereby enabling them to fight for and win increased wages, leading to more spending, job creation and corporate vitalization. The DP candidate slammed those who cast concerns over the national debt, surpassing 1 quadrillion won, or around $720 billion, saying it's less than 50% of the gross domestic product, relatively lower than other countries. He claimed that while other countries supported their economy and citizens during the COVID-19 pandemic by increasing their sovereign debt, South Korea only lent people money, which resulted in a skyrocketing debt among small businesses and households.
Meanwhile, Lee's rival, the People Power Party presidential candidate Kim Moon-soo, promised to resolve issues surrounding public transportation used by commuters from the Greater Seoul area while touring Gyeonggi Province.
While speaking at Hwajeong Station in Goyang, Gyeonggi Province on Wednesday, Kim pledged a revolution in public transportation to ensure travel anywhere in the capital region within 1 hour. Kim also pledged to explore other ways to introduce alternative forms of public transportation to help lower commuting costs for Goyang residents. The PPP candidate is scheduled to continue his tour of the province, making stops in the cities of Gimpo, Paju, Dongducheon, Yangju and Namyangju. Meanwhile, Lee Jun-seok, the candidate for the New Reform Party, addressed the 2025 Asian Leadership Conference in Seoul on Wednesday, saying he's squarely focused on fulfilling his duty to the younger generation that has consistently supported him and progressive voters who want reform.
In other news, South Korea and the United States began a new round of working-level talks in Washington on Tuesday to discuss U.S. reciprocal tariffs and other issues. What do we know?
Well, according to a source familiar with the talks, a South Korean delegation led by Chang Song-gil, arrived in the U.S. on Tuesday for the second round of technical discussions with officials from the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. The first round of talks took place in Washington on April the 30th, May the 1st. Officials from the Trade Ministry, as well as the Ministries of Agriculture, Oceans, Finance and Foreign Affairs, are participating in the latest talks, which will continue through Thursday. The meetings will focus on six key areas: balance trade, non-tariff barriers, economic security, digital trade, rules of origin and commercial considerations. These are expected to be the final in-person negotiations before South Korea's presidential election on the 3rd of June.
That's where we wrap up our news briefing today. Hee Jin, thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
The finish line for the 21st presidential election is already in sight. Overseas voting began Tuesday, and early voting will begin in just over a week's time as well. Meanwhile, the presidential candidates faced off in the first of three televised debates on Sunday. There were four candidates who took the stage: Lee Jae-myung of the Democratic Party, Kim Moon-soo of the People Power Party, Lee Jun-seok of the Minor New Reform Party, and Kwon Young-guk of the Minor Democratic Labour Party. During the two-hour debate on revitalising the economy and trade strategies, they clashed over various issues, including how to approach trade negotiations with Trump. To discuss the debate and where things stand for another edition of Wednesday Election Watch, first we have with us on the line our regular contributor for this segment, briefing us on the latest developments and more, reporter Shim Kyu-seok from AFP. Mr. Shim, hello and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And providing us with analysis this week, we have with us veteran journalist who's been covering Korea for over 40 years now, Mr. Michael Breen. Mr. Breen, hello. It's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Shim, let's start with the debate. For our listeners, can you briefly walk us through how Sunday's debate went and the issues that were addressed.
Yeah, the topic of the first debate on Sunday was the economy, and the moderator fielded questions about strategies to overcome low growth, as you said, trade policy in relation to Trump, and general plans to strengthen the country's competitiveness. It was a little bit surprising that the debate didn't specifically cover the real estate market as well as the national debt and tax policy, which have traditionally been sort of cleavage points in prior debates. But, the debate, as it was relatively heated, was expected, with the DP's Lee Jae-myung fending off attacks from the PPP's Kim Eun-soo and the Reform Party's Lee Jun-seop, who was definitely the more spirited of the two in criticizing Lee Jae-myung. For instance, the two accused Lee Jae-myung of being pro-China, citing his comments that South Korea does not need to get involved in China-Taiwan disputes. But Lee, who considers pragmatism as key to his foreign policy, said the country should really navigate its strategy based on national interest. There was also clashes about labor, about AI policy and AI investment, as well as labor regulations and energy policy.
Right, and what's been the broad consensus of how the debate went? What have the different parties been saying?
Yeah, I mean, from what I've gleaned, the debate proceeded largely as a lot of expectations went. And while, analyst opinions on candidates' performances varied, I think the general consensus is that the debate is really unlikely to have a major impact on the race as it stands now. So Lee Jae-myung is a front runner. So he opted for a defensive strategy by underscoring stability and his readiness to assume leadership. While Kim Eun-soo and Lee Jun-seop took the aggressive approach in attacking me as lacking in detail and generally his policies being unfeasible. So Lee Jae-myung later described the debate as a serious discussion addressing the nation's challenges and said he was committed to further dialogue. But Lee Jun-seop, by contrast, criticized the debate, saying the meaningful discourse was really unattainable due to Lee Jae-myung's lack of detailed preparation. For example, he targeted Lee Jae-myung's proposal to invest the 100 trillion won in AI, saying that it lacked clarity and was met with a lack of substantive explanations. And Kim Eun-soo, after the debate, he expressed the desire for unity, suggesting that Lee Jun-seop, a former PPP, who was leader of the former PPP in the past, should collaborate with the party. So, he hinted at potential consolidation. The other minor party, Kwon Young-guk candidate, he said he felt marginalized during the debate and said the discussions were predominantly centered on investment and growth rather than the struggles of the underprivileged.
Okay, so, Mr. Breen, what did you make of the debate? Who do you think won the debate? Was there a winner?
I think you could say Lee Jun-seop, who's like a generation younger than the others and, went to Harvard, very smart. He appeared to win it in a sort of technical sense. If this were not an election, if it was sort of a TV show, who performed best? Who was the most articulate? Then I would say he probably won it. But, this is an election, and so what the candidates, they don't so much have to win a debate or come out looking best. They have to get undecided voters or people voting for other candidates to switch to them. Mm. So from that perspective, I would say Lee Jae-myung, who is the major opposition candidate and the front runner at the moment, was the winner. He looked presidential. He almost looked kind of like a teacher, teaching his, particularly when he was talking to his main opponent, Kim Eun-soo. He almost looked like a teacher. And Kim Eun-soo seemed uncomfortable. He seemed to not have a full grasp of his own positions, as if he had sort of memorized them or something. I mean, this is a sort of an impression. I don't know how fair it is. And what I think we need to remember is that Kim Mun-soo is the representative of the current ruling party, and Lee, Lee Jae-myung, is the from the opposition party. So the opposition, in a debate, the opposition has an advantage in that it can criticise what we've all been familiar with the last few years. But it almost looked like the other way round from the point of view of who looked more solid and secure. It looked like, as I say, I think Lee Jae-myung looked very presidential. I'd make one other point, which is the debate wasn't that interesting.
Okay.
Which in some ways in a democracy is a good thing. You know, it was about policy. We're told that Lee comes from the liberal side, and the other, or two of them were from the liberal left side and two others conservative. If you just looked at their policies, it's hard to distinguish between that. And yet this election is being characterized, particularly by some on the right, as a struggle for liberal democracy, as if one side's in favor of liberal democracy and the other side's actually in favor of going communist or something. So none of that was apparent from the actual discussion. It was a debate around policies to do with sort of real things, you know, AI, energy, infrastructure, things like that, which people might find a bit boring. But that encouraged me. It makes me feel that our democracy is not as rattled as we thought it was by the recent events.
Right, you said Lee Jae-myung is the front runner. Let's get some figures on that now. Mr. Shim, I understand that you have one of the latest polls from the major pollsters. Can you tell us where the candidates stand at the moment, according to the polls?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't really able to find the polls that definitively, you know, reflect the, you know, respondents, you know, their reactions to the debate. So there weren't any, clearly after the debate. But according to one Real Meter poll commissioned by the Energy Economy newspaper conducted May 14th to 16th, so this was before the debate on Sunday, between 1,509 respondents found Lee Jae-myung leading with 50.2%, PPP's Kim Mun-soo at 35.6 points, and the Reform Party's Lee Jun-seok at 8.7%. So this poll had a confidence rating of 95% and a margin of error at plus and minus 2.5%.
Right, so Lee Jae-myung at 50.2%, Kim Mun-soo at 35.6%, so about 14, 15 points behind, and Lee Jun-seok at 8.7%. And as we said, unfortunately, this poll does not reflect the debates as the survey was conducted before then. But still, Mr. Breen, what do you make of these polls? And do you think the TV debate will affect these figures?
I think you might get the New Reform Party candidate, the other Lee.
Lee Jun-seok.
Lee Jun-seok. I hadn't forgotten his name. He may get a few more votes out of this because I hear, and this is just anecdotal, but I hear from academics I know that among students in their class, it was a contest between the two Lees. In other words, they preferred the younger Lee Jun-seok over Kim Mun-soo. So that might get reflected a little bit. But otherwise, I think there may be percentage here or there, but I think the pattern is established. It'll be hard to move. There was one interesting thing. The Mail Business newspaper also, now I'm not sure what days these were. I think these were the same, around the same time. But they had Lee Jae-myung at 47.7. and Kim Mun-soo at 33.3. But interestingly, among centrist voters, voters in the middle, so not on the right, not on the left, Lee Jae-myung's at 55.8% and Kim Mun-soo at 23.6%. So this means Kim Mun-soo has a real uphill battle to try and win them over, win over the centre.
Right, just to give more details on that, the MBN poll mentioned just now was conducted by Next Research from the 16th to the 18th of May on 1,007 adults nationwide and has a confidence level of 95% with a margin of error of plus minus 3.1%. Interesting figures, but Lee Jae-myung in the lead, and you don't think the TV debates will have shifted the needle much in the process, you're saying then. Let's talk about another major development that came over the weekend. In a message posted on his social media on Saturday, the former president, Yoon Suk-yeol, said he was leaving the People Power Party. So, Mr. Shim, can you give us more details about this, what he said about his departure from the PPP and what has triggered this as well?
Right. So, Yoon, on Saturday, he announced via Facebook that he was leaving the party, the People's Power Party, saying he was stepping away, quote, to fulfill his responsibility to protect the Free Republic of Korea. He also called the snap election the last chance to prevent totalitarian dictatorship and protect liberal democracy and the rule of law. So it's the kind of rhetoric that Mr. Breen mentioned, that conservatives are sort of casting the election as. So his Yoon's departure comes amid this mounting pressure within the party and plummeting public support following, you know, Yoon's impeachment over the martial law declaration last year. So Yoon urged voters, his supporters, to back the PPP presidential candidate, Kim Mun-soo, who had previously declined to oust Yoon from the party. So I think we can interpret his exit as a part of an effort to improve the party's electoral prospects by sort of distancing himself, his legacy from the party. And it sort of also frees Kim from the risk of alienating the party's conservative base, you know, had he decided to push Yoon out. But Yoon, interesting, he has also made clear today that he really isn't willing to step outside the public eye as a whole. He notably watched a film today propagating the conspiracy theory about election fraud that justified his martial law declaration last year. So it's clear that he is very much willing to stay in the in public scrutiny.
Right, so Yoon has left the party of his own accord and he, in the end, wasn't kicked out by the party or by the presidential candidate, Kim Mun-soo. Mr. Breen, what did you make of his decision and what does it mean for the PPP and for their candidate, Kim Mun-soo, do you think?
Well, first of all, I suspect he was pushed out. I suspect he was asked to leave. I mean, I don't have any proof, I suspect it. But, you know, if we step back a little bit and look at Korea more historically, in almost every presidency, not all of them, but most, by the end of a presidential term, the popularity, the approval rating has gone down so low, people are kind of fed up and want something new, that the candidate for the ruling party doesn't want the incumbent president campaigning with them to help them because they're not going to help them. So Yoon's either was told to do this or saw it himself that he, by associating with Kim Mun-soo, his party's candidate, he was damaging Kim's chances. So he left. The statement he made about, you know, this election is a crucial crossroads for this country. Do we continue the liberal democracy or go down the path of authoritarianism or whatever? I found very irresponsible because it's a way of catastrophizing what is basically a normal left-right divide and confrontation and argument within a democratic structure. This sort of idea that free democracy is being threatened is just not true. But, you know, it's something that Yoon believes, and it's something that actually drove his martial law decision, which ended in his impeachment. So he's history already, and we're going to see the end of him, but he's doesn't seem to want to go yet. He, you know, as long as there are microphones turned in his direction when he turns up and cameras shot, he wants to say something. But I don't see him having a big impact on anything.
Well, still with President Yoon's departure from the party, one of the key questions and variables that had been hanging over the election has been resolved. Mr. Shim, what other variables do you think we need to watch out for in the lead up to Election Day, June 3rd?
I mean, yeah, there are, of course, two more debates coming up, TV debates, one on social issues on the 23rd. And the last on the 27th, covering political issues, I expect maybe constitutional reform or other political, you know, key issues will be covered then. And, you know, with less than 2 weeks, we can also expect possible talks between the People's Power Party and the Yoon-suk's Reform Party in fielding a single conservative candidate. And which, you know, from Kim Mun-soo's perspective, and his party has been floating and pushing for some time now. But Lee Jun-suk has consistently expressed the view that he will see the race to its end. And he said he wouldn't. He even today, there was an attempt by the PPP. One of the PPP's lawmakers tried to, you know, coax Lee into sort of a discussions, but Lee flatly said he would not. But if the Yoon Suk support rises beyond a meaningful level, this may, you know, persuade him to negotiate with the PPP. Otherwise, I think it may be more politically significant for him to stay in the race. I mean, he's only 40 after all, and seems to be harboring sort of a more long-term goal. And this election may be a good opportunity for him to demonstrate to voters of his competitiveness, which could boost his prospects later on in representing a major party. So he doesn't really, I think, feel the pressure, I think it's more likely that he'll stick to it until the end.
Right, Mr. Breen, what are your thoughts on a potential merger between Kim Mun-soo and Lee Jun-suk to represent the conservative bloc, essentially, as a unified candidate to go up against the DP candidate, Lee Jae-myung? The speculation continues to swell. It has swelled ever since that debate. They've been appearing in some events together as well, most notably a debate hosted by the Seoul mayor, Oh Se-hun. But Lee Jun-suk has denied it since then as well, that he's not going to unify. But still, do you think there is a potential for a merger? And if so, do you think a unified candidacy has a chance against Lee Jae-myung, who is the outright front runner at the moment?
I think, you know, I think it's from the conservative point of view, it's desirable because one of their weaknesses, in fact, their main weakness, and the reason that it's so difficult for their party to get traction, is the question of unity. I mean, let's not forget, just a few days ago, the leaders of the party were trying to force Mr. Kim, who the members of the party had chosen as a candidate, were trying to force him to step down in favour of the former prime minister, who was a non-party member. So they're really disunited. So unity on their side would have a good look. That would be good for them. Whether it's going to happen or not, Lee Jun-suk's adamant statement that, no, this won't happen, could be a negotiating tactic. You know, if he's easy, what is the upside for him? Now, if I were him and Kim Mun-soo came to me and said, look, together we have a chance of winning, and if I win, you'll be the prime minister. I think, okay, there's something. But the chances are, you know, the people who give up and then ask their supporters to vote for somebody else, they're forgotten. So I think Mr. Shim's point is spot on, that he wants to stay relevant. He's only 40. He's going to be around for another 40 years. So he wants to stay relevant, and to be a losing candidate rather than somebody who disappeared is better for him. My money is on them not uniting. If they were to what extent, how close would that bring them to Lee Jae-myung? I don't know. If they were to win, I can guarantee you that the Democratic side would now be the ones claiming election fraud. You know, it seems very unlikely. I don't see a unified Conservative candidate winning. I see them getting, not doing too badly, but not enough.
Well, we're out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there for this week's Wednesday Election Watch. We'll be back next week with more updates from the election. But for this week, we wrap it up here. We've been speaking to reporter Shim Kyu-suk from AFP and veteran journalist Michael Breen. Thank you once again for your time.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 23.78 points, or 0.91% Wednesday, to close at 2,625.58. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ gained 8.07 points, or 1.13%, to close at 723.62. You can check for Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, it's Korea Trending, our daily segment where we round up some of the most viewed stories and issues on Korean news outlets outside of our news briefing headlines. And to bring us those stories, we have with us Daniel Che, our KBS World Radio news editor. Daniel, hello. It's good to see you.
Good to see you too, Jang-ho.
What do you have for us first?
South Korea has been implementing a new AI technology to help fight digital sex crimes.
Right, and it sounds quite impressive. They claim they can identify such content in real time and request deletion in just a matter of minutes.
Well, the newly developed AI tool is South Korea's first AI-powered system, and it can generate a report of its findings, automatically draft an email requesting the deletion of the content, and the email and report are then checked by an official in charge before it is sent to the website operators. In other words, it can drastically slash the time required to monitor, detect, report, and request removal all the way down to just 6 minutes, a drastic upgrade, as previously the entire process took approximately 2.5 to 3 hours, as authorities had to manually locate illegal videos circulating on social media platforms, online communities, and illicit websites, and then file deletion requests with the respective sites.
Right. Authorities have attempted to use AI for such purposes in the past, but as you said, this appears to be a significant upgrade.
It is. In 2023, the government worked with the Seoul Institute to monitor sexually exploitative content on social media websites, online communities, and the dark web using AI. The function was limited to just monitoring back then. The city government also set up a one-stop support center for digital sex crime victims, which not only helped remove sexually exploitative content, but also provides investigative and legal support, psychological therapy, and medical assistance for the victims. Amid increasing number of cases where sexually exploitative videos are uploaded to foreign servers, the city government will also be able to monitor content posted overseas. The Seoul Digital Foundation has changed its name to the Seoul AI Foundation to make a fresh start as the central organization in charge of the capital's AI policy.
Yes, hopefully this can be a significant step in tackling the scourge that is the dissemination of digital sex crimes. Okay, let's move on to our second story. Tomorrow marks International Day for Biological Diversity, and we're learning that we've been seeing some encouraging related digits here in Korea over the years.
Yes, the Environment Ministry is set to hold related celebrations on Thursday at the Sejong National Arboretum to promote the importance of working towards harmonious coexistence with nature to build a sustainable future, as well as to highlight the importance of preserving biodiversity. And commendation award ceremonies will be held as well. But before that, the National Institute of Biological Resources revealed the data on the eve of the big commemorative day. In the past decade, the number of species found in the Korean Peninsula rose by 35%. The number of species listed to be living in the nation stood at around 61,200. In 2024, that's about an increase of 16,000 since the year 2015. In protected wetland areas alone, the figure spiked fivefold during that period.
Those are impressive figures, and actually a close look apparently reveals that's only part of the story.
Not at all. Officials believe there is a greater number of species in the peninsula than what's listed. They believe it should easily surpass 100,000, with many species still left uncovered, and new ones are continually added to the list with more to come. Along with continued discovery and listing of species, efforts to preserve biodiversity in the nation include identifying endangered species, with the number increased from 246 in 2015 to 282 last year. Other important tasks include identifying and preventing the influx of invasive species from abroad. The number of such listed species has been more than doubled in the past decade. Regulations have been enforced to prevent such species from entering, and just as important are expansion of conservation areas, such as expansions are visible in various parts from wetlands to marine protected areas and national parks.
Let's shift gears to news from the film industry now. The explosive success of the horror thriller film Exhumer was made evident as it won not one, not two, but four awards overall at the Director's Cut Awards. Can you tell us more?
Well, Exhumer won a lot of awards there. The 23rd edition of the event, it was held. The top honor went to Exhumer, of course, as in the best director. It was recognized by other filmmakers. Chang Jae-hyun is the director for Exhumer, and he received the most votes from members of the Korean Film Directors Guild, beating out tough competition, including Kim Young-ju for The Match, Nam Dong-hyuk for Handsome Guys, and Bong Joon-ho for Mickey 17. Exhumer is only Chang's third feature film, and he shines in a cult films, a genre that can be quite challenging to have a wide audience appeal. And Exhumer also helped Chang earn another recognition at the event, Best Screenplay Award, further acknowledging his talent as a writer. Chang Ji-hyun's third feature film made history in the occult genre by attracting over 10 million viewers. A Best Actress went to Kim Go-eun for her role as a shaman in that movie. Yi Do-hyun, who played Kim's assistant in the movie, helped haul in the Best Newcomer Award, all for Exhumer.
Not to be upstaged was actor Lee Byung-hun, who grabbed back-to-back Best Actor recognition at the Director's Cut Awards.
Lee won this year's award for The Match, based on real events in which he played Cho Hun-hyun, a baduk or go genius who dominated the sport for many years until he trained and raised a super genius that grew up to be his arch nemesis. Still cuts showing side-by-side comparisons of the baduk star and of Lee almost flawlessly dressing, posing, and reenacting scenes featuring the real Cho Hun-hyun served as some of the most effective marketing promos for the movie. Last year, Yi won Best Actor for Concrete Utopia at this very award ceremony. He already made successful debuts and transitions in Hollywood and continues to cross over a great variety of genres and also between TV series and movies in Korea and abroad.
And finally, shifting our focus from screen to print, the Seoul International Book Fair will be kicking off next month. What can we expect in this year's edition?
The 2025 SIBF, organized by the Korean Publishers Association, is on from June 18th to 22nd at COEX in Seoul. Over 530 publishers and literary organizations, including 100 overseas publishers from 16 countries, are all invited. This year's theme, The Last Resort. It was chosen to have participants reflect on the idea of personal refuge in uncertain times. A diverse lineup of Korean authors will be present, including Kim Hye-ran, International Booker shortlisted author Bora Chung of Curse Bunny will debut her new release, The Children's House. Korean-American author Kim Joo-hae of Beasts of a Little Land will discuss her latest novel, City of Night Birds. Also featured is actor and publisher Park Jung-min, along with star chef Choi Kang-rok from Culinary Class Wars, who will unveil his new book.
Some big names there indeed, but one figure that's set to appear at the book fair seems to tower over most, the legendary filmmaker Park Chan-wook as well.
Yes, in terms of global recognition, certainly. Renowned for his visually striking and psychologically complex films, Park often drew inspiration from literature. The transition from print to screen is never easy, but Park has adapted several novels into screen productions with great success, the more recent ones being HBO series The Sympathizer last year and the BBC series The Little Drummer Girl in 2019. Even his breakout masterpiece Old Boy is based on a Japanese manga or graphic novel. Interestingly, when the Korean movie, which continues to be hailed as somewhat of an inspirational go-to book or Bible for many modern filmmakers, was adopted by Hollywood director Spike Lee, it validated how it is impossible for anyone else to work that magic of transition. During his talk on June 20th, titled Park Chan-wook's Literary Anchors, Park will discuss elements of novels that captivate him, the process of translating literature into cinema, and the books that have deeply influenced his creative vision.
That's all for Korea Trending today. Daniel, thank you for those stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
We continue on to Korea Book Club, our weekly segment where we dive into the world of Korean literature through notable recent works in both Korean and in English translation. This week we have with us Barry Welsh, our literary critic and long-time contributor. He joins us in the studio now. Barry, hello. It's great to have you with us again.
Yes, hello. It's great to be here.
So what book are you introducing to our listeners today?
So today we are reviewing Snow Globe 2. The Korean title is Snowball. And this is the gripping final installment in So-young Park's dystopian young adult saga. It was translated by Chongmin E. Comfort, who also translated the first installment in the series. And the novel was published in Korea in 2021, and this English translation has only just been published in the last month or two. And if you enjoyed the high-stakes drama of series like The Hunger Games or the moral twists of Squid Game, then this series delivers something similar with its own unique interpretation. In this sequel, we return to Cho Bam, who's the main character, and her once perfect life inside the glittering dome of Snow Globe has completely unraveled at the end of the first part, which we reviewed a couple of years ago. And I don't want to give any spoilers away, so I'll try to skim over some of the plot details.
Well, as you said, we reviewed the book, the first book, I think just over a year ago now, actually.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah.
And of course, we should warn our listeners before we go on that, because we are reviewing part two of the story, we are going to have to talk about some spoilers from part one, I think.
I'll try to keep it light. I won't give too much away.
Sure.
But yeah, so the main character is Cho Bam, and at the end of the first book, she learned this horrifying truth about her idol, Harry, who was kind of a very famous reality TV star, and she sort of exposed the lie behind this, Harry's reality TV show, and then faced some significant consequences. The villain of the first book, Director Cha, is in prison now, but there's a new powerful, or the real power in this universe is the Ebon Media Group, and they are still in control of Snow Globe, and they're determined to bury these sort of secrets that came to light in the first book. So also, this is a sort of a post-environmental disaster dystopia. So the society, or the world, literally heats up as the climate inside the Snow Globe dome shifts and changes. And there's a lot happening in this book. So Cho Bam is accused or framed of committing a murder, and the heir to the Ebon Media Group is sort of a will-she-won't-ly kind of relationship with Bon Hui, the young heir to this dynasty. So there's lots of suspense, lots of twists, lots of social commentary, like in the first book. And it's really, you have Cho Bam and her sort of friends racing to uncover the truth behind this manufactured reality before it's too late. And like the first book, it's very fast-paced, it's dark, and perfect for fans of dystopian fiction.
Yes, this is another YA dystopian fiction book in that genre. But as we said, as we're going to talk more about part two, I think just our listeners should be aware that there might be some spoilers coming up ahead.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, let's keep on going. So tell us more about what happens in Snow Globe 2 and how does it build on the first book?
Okay, so this is the conclusion to the story. So it's a duology. And it picks up right after the big revelations at the end of the first book. Our main character, Chobam, she once thought that she was playing the role of a beloved reality TV star named Harry, but now she knows the shocking truth. It's difficult to, going to have to reveal this, but she is one of a number of clones, which was part of a secret project run by this powerful media group, the Ebon Media Group. She's not the only one. There's several clones. And in Snow Globe 2, everybody knows about this clone scandal, and it's really how the story develops after this big revelation. So Chobam and these other clones are still being watched very closely, this time as stars of their own very popular reality TV show. At the same time, she's also trying to discover the secrets about how this Snow Globe society operates, and you know, it has these sort of strange Weller phenomena which are designed to distract or control the public. There's a hidden power plant run by exploited workers and so on. So the stakes in this story are much higher than in the first book, and it's much more surreal. Takes some very strange directions at times, but Chobam is still the centre of the story. She's still trying to stay alive as various people scheme to murder her or do various nasty things to her. A big part of the story is that she's framed for murder, and you don't know who has done this to her or who she can trust and so on. And it's full of twists, and it's really a story about media manipulation, about power, about identity, and it builds on most of the things that made the first book so intriguing, and also expands the world in some very, very unexpected and often quite unsettling directions.
Okay, so we've made the comparison already, but this series is often compared to things like The Hunger Games, Squid Game, and Orphan Black. Do you think those comparisons accurate, are fair?
Yeah, sure. So all of those comparisons do make sense. Even just so you get as a shorthand so for understanding the vibe or the atmosphere of the series. But Snow Globe does have its own unique elements. Like Hunger Games, it is exploring a deeply unequal society where you have the suffering of many people used for the entertainment of the elite. Like Squid Game, it has this sort of element of surveillance culture, this idea that nothing is really as it seems. And like Orphan Black, you have this clone storyline that dives into questions of identity or autonomy or what makes us truly human. But where Snow Globe is different is that it has this blend of Korean pop culture and its own sort of a flavor of dystopian, environmental dystopian science fiction. So it really feels like reading a slick, polished, high-stakes K-drama with sort of sci-fi elements. You have the very glamorous settings and power struggles within these big corporations and powerful families. There's a bit of dark comedy at times. There's these sort of dramatic shifts in the weather, which is a big part of the story. You have these sort of storms and disasters which are kind of staged as distractions. And what's really interesting, though, is it's not about physical survival like in The Hunger Games or Squid Game. Really, the story here, it's about manipulating the truth or the memory or the image of people. So people are using their sort of reality TV images to sort of try and fight become more popular than other people.
Right.
This Ebon Media Group, they don't just control the people, they also control this narrative. And so the story is about who gets to control the narrative. And I think that makes this book very timely. It's not about fighting to the death. It's about fighting to control the narrative narrative about what's real in a world built on lies and illusion.
Well, once again, it's called Snow Globe 2 by Park So-young, translated by Changmin Lee Comfort. And that was our pick for Korea Book Club this week. Barry, thank you for that review. It's been a pleasure as always. And we'll talk again soon. Take care.
Okay, take care.
And that brings us to the end of our show. Join us again tomorrow for more news, views and reviews from Korea. Till then, we hope you have a great day. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho. And thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio.